This is Christy, and we have merchandise. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com and check out amazing t-shirts, mugs, stickers. If you love great quotes, we have some of our favorites. If you love silliness, check out our mascot, Brain Man. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com, clip on the shop button, and find something for that person who needs to be reminded that we are fashion creatures but half made up. Mary Shelley said that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Christy Shriver, and we're here to discuss books that have changed the world and have changed us.
And I'm Gary Shriver, and this is the How to Love Lit podcast. Today, we are finishing the reading and discussion over Jack London's most anthologized short story, To Build a Fire. Last week, we looked at Jack London's life story, the setting of the story in Canada's Great Klondike area, as well as the beginning of the story in today, we will put the story in its literary and philosophical context, as well as finishing reading most of it. Now, there's a disclosure, because this story is longer than most short stories. We will read most of it. We will make a few edits because there's a lot of philosophy to discuss here.
Well, the reason why this story is considered London's best is not because it's the most exciting, because it isn't, but because he's able to encapsulate an entire worldview within a single story, and that is not easy to do.
So let's start with that. Worldview, simply stated, is our orientation in looking at reality. It's just as much about our heart as it is our brain. I mean, it's unconscious as much as it is conscious. And it's those ideas and our preferences inside of us really that inform how we look at things and how we hear things and how we understand things.
Right. And in theory, we all see the same thing, right? But when we take what we take from what we see maybe isn't the same thing. Our religion, our education, our culture, all these things play into our worldview. It's our response to those basic philosophical questions. What's really real? What constitutes a human being? What happens to a person after they die? How is it possible to know anything? What's right and wrong? What's the meaning of human history?
Oh my gosh, do we have time for all that? I mean, you know, those are all the things we tend to think belong to the realms of philosophy and psychology, and of course they do. But actually, every single person must answer those questions for themselves, and we can't get away from it, whether we realize it or not. And it shows up in our values, our culture, our politics, our spending habits, and absolutely everything is influenced by worldview.
Well, and for sure, it's going to show up in our literature. I mean, if we look at Western literature, especially that's written in English, you know, for years it was written from a Christian worldview. Beowulf was written by a Christian. Shakespeare was writing from a Christian worldview. Emily Bronte writing from a Christian worldview. I mean, these are works that reference heaven and hell. They're full of biblical allusions. There's a certain understood moral code.
So are you making a claim that all these writers were Christians?
No. But their perspective of the text is coming from that direction. For example, Shakespeare may or may not have been a Christian himself, but when we read Macbeth, we see references to hell, and hell is defined in the Christian way. And there's a concern with evil and choosing evil and other values as they are defined by this Christian worldview. We see the same thing in Wuthering Heights, where there's a theme of redemption and forgiveness. These are Christian concerns, and they dominate not just the sacred text of the Bible, but they influence the writers who thought about them. John Donne, there's another example. He wrote a poem titled The Flea, and the poem is about seducing a woman, not necessarily a Christian-endorsed activity, but that's why it's funny. It uses religious language and Christian references to make a case against chastity. In order for the humor to work, Donne has to presuppose a certain worldview.
Now, I want to point out this isn't just something that's relevant for writers. Scientists, historians, and politicians all can be identified by their worldview. And it's good to know their worldview when you study their work. I mean, I'm thinking if we're talking about Christian worldviews, we're talking about Copernicus and Galileo and Pascal and George Washington Carver, Martin Luther King Jr., the Wright brothers. I mean, even entertainers like Mozart and Beethoven. Or even Carrie Underwood.
Well, exactly. And the literature they write reflect their view of the world. So in the American historical context, we left this Christian theistic tradition, which we had with the Puritan writers, and we moved into something called deism. And then from there, we moved into the 18th century and into a period that we called Romanticism.
Now, deism, for clarification, is the idea that there is a God, but he's like the removed clockmaker. I mean, he made the world, he wound it up, but he has no interest in human affairs. God and the world can be known by looking at nature. We understand the laws of God by understanding the laws of nature, or in other words, natural law.
Right. And this is what I mean by the literature of these writers. When you read those guys, like the Declaration of Independence, it says things like, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. There's some presuppositions in that. It presupposes that truth is self-evident by looking at nature, and that naturally we're all equal. We're created by a supreme power, but you know, this supreme power doesn't have a personality, but biologically we're the same, and this is observable in nature. There's not a ranking system, a caste, no personal divinity.
Well, you know, Benjamin Franklin, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson, but James Madison, George Washington likely fall into this camp. Along with Mark Twain and Victor Hugo and Alexander Pope and David Hume and Napoleon Bonaparte. I mean, there's just a few names. I even think Marlon Brando made a similar claim.
Well, that brings us to our guy, Jack London. He endorsed or believed or read a different philosophy, which is called naturalism. And naturalism claims that everything can be explained naturally, just like deism. But naturalism does not presuppose a divinity. Naturalism does not have a Bible or a text that determines right and wrong. In fact, for naturalists, right and wrong does not exist. There is only cause and effect. Matter exists, but the cosmos is ruled by cause and effect. Death is the extinction of personality and individuality. Ethics is related only to human beings and stems from our need to organize ourselves. This is the idea as verbalized by French physiologist Pierre-Jean-Georges Cabanis. The brain secretes thoughts as the liver secretes bile. You know, Jack London was reading these ideas. I mean, he was reading the ideas of Darwin and Nietzsche and Spencer and Huxley and Marx and many others, naturalist philosophers.
Right. And these men, among others, really changed the world in big ways philosophically.
And these are the ideas that London was reading when he was in the Klondike, struggling in this naturally difficult environment. He's looking at life through the lens of cause and effect, not good and evil. The universe is not out to get the man in the story. The universe just is what it is. Morality is determined by what we want out of our relationships. What do we want with other people in the natural world? And how we choose to relate to these things determines what happens to us.
Well, Origin of the Species was one of the few books that London took with him in the Yukon, and he read it with temperatures that were sometimes outside 70 degrees below zero, a little bit colder than where we live, you know. And Darwin's theory of evolution maintains that natural selection is a process developed by random chance. It's mechanical, it's indifferent, it's remorseless, it favors the species over the individual. And, you know, Herbert Spencer's phrase, survival of the fittest, fits here. And this man in London's story is definitely not the fittest.
No. You know, like a lot of naturalist stories, this story is written from a scientific point of view. The narrator is detached, impersonal. The story speaks about cause and effect. I keep saying that. Notice all the references to cause and effect, and not just between the relationship between the man and the environment, also the relationship between the man and the dog and the man and the old timer. The narrator does not speak in terms of moral judgment. It's not about doing the right thing or the wrong thing. It's about cause and effect. And this story, we don't see the man being privileged over the dog. They're both just animals facing a set of circumstances. One is not morally above the other. One is better suited to the environment than the other, but they are both equally subject to the same laws of nature. Naturalistic writing is often considered deterministic for this reason, meaning there's not a supernatural being that's going to come in and change something. There's no romantic hero who's going to come and save the day. There's no prince. There's just life and the laws that govern it.
And yet, that phrase, survival of the fittest, is actually tricky. It really doesn't have a clear definition. You know, for some, it means if you're not fit, you just die off. It's not personal. There is no ethics in evolution. Charles Darwin was the first to understand the implications of that. I mean, in one letter to the botanist J.D. Hooker, he said this: "What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horridly cruel works of nature." You know, these guys don't see nature like our friend Thoreau did out on Walden Pond. In Darwin's world, nature is not our friend. It's not our enemy. It just is. And sometimes it's merciless.
You know, there are other poets who wrote about nature like that. Tennyson, in the famous poem In Memoriam, calls nature red in tooth and claw.
Yes, and American philosopher Daniel Dennett calls evolution a mindless, purposeless, algorithmic process operating at the cellular level. I mean, randomness is an important feature, and the survival of the fittest is ruthless and cold.
And in that way, we see it reflected in the setting. Klondike can be symbolic. Nature is cold.
True. And yet cold is not the only characteristic of naturalism. There were two important naturalist thinkers who interpreted evolution differently. Herbert Spencer and Thomas Huxley. I mean, Thomas Huxley is Aldous Huxley of Brave New World's grandfather. But Spencer at the time was the more popular, and he coined the phrase survival of the fittest. And for Spencer, competition was good because it weeded out the inferior and it improved the breed. And he believed this principle applies to living organisms and society. And Huxley disagreed. In his famous lecture, Evolution and Ethics, he says this: "Social progress means a checking of the cosmic process at every step and the substitution for it of another, which may be called the ethical process, the end of which is not the survival of those who happen to be the fittest in the rest of the whole of the conditions which obtain, but of those who are ethically the best." That's a wide disagreement on the interpretation of evolution right there.
Well, yeah, because for Huxley, ethically the best doesn't necessarily mean genetically the most fit. I mean, London had a lot of respect for the argument that these two men were having, and he understood both sides. He thought these were important ideas and they needed to be discussed, and lots of writers were discussing them. Of course, chief of the naturalist writers and probably the most important writer of his day was the French writer Émile Zola. In his stories, characters lived and they were shaped and they were conditioned, and to be honest, mostly destroyed by social and biological forces that were absolutely beyond their control. And Zola believed writing should apply scientific accuracy and detachment to their stories. And lots of writers, you know, followed this model. They wrote about things that were unpleasant, but that were real. Lots of times it was the condition of urban and industrial life. I mean, London's stories are set in the natural environment, but honestly, he's kind of the anomaly for his generation. Most naturalist writers were writing about industrialization and the urban environments. They were writing about the industrial world and how it could be just awful. You know, Theodore Dreiser with Sister Carrie, for example, or Upton Sinclair, famously in the book The Jungle, where he talked about, you know, a meatpacking plant.
Oh, yes. And the conditions in those meatpacking plants were worse than he even described. We'll find out later on.
Well, naturalism for these writers meant life as it naturally was. And this meant being honest about the disparity between what is ideal and what really is happening. I mean, don't candy coat things. Life is hard. The rules that apply in nature, both in the wild, but naturally among men, are brutal. Our freedom is limited to the circumstances that we find ourselves. And sometimes that means darkness, I mean, gloom, despair. The nature of life can be an immense and maybe an uncontrollable force. And a lot of these naturalist stories try to portray what that looks like. On the one hand, it can mean man loses. In fact, you know, eventually that man always loses. But there is this dichotomy that can also express itself. And for London, even in the harshest environment of nature, there is still a benevolent force at work. Man, even in the harshest of circumstances, has the intuit to truth. When and if he will use that, man can use truth to order his life for survival. And that's what we see, even in the Klondike. So our guy, though, he's an unimaginative newcomer. And here he is. He's lit out on the trail with a dog and lunch and weather that is at least 55 below zero. His goal is a warm fire and a bunch of buddies by supper. Not really a bad goal.
No, it's not. And I would like to point out before we jump into this that these ideas of naturalism, if you want to talk about the ideas having consequences, naturalism is going to be the foundation of imperialism and everything that leads to World War I. So these are big deals. But the story will start like this. The dog dropped in again at his heels with a tail drooping discouragement as the man swung along the creek bed. The furrow of the old sled trail was plainly visible, but a dozen inches of snow covered the marks of the last runners. In a month, no man had come up or down that silent creek. The man held steadily on. He was not much given to thinking, and just in particular, he had nothing to think about, save that he would eat lunch at the Forks, and that at 6 o'clock he would be in the camp with the boys. There was nobody to talk to, and had there been, speech would have been impossible because of the ice muzzle on his mouth. So he continued monotonously to chew tobacco and to increase the length of his amber beard. Once in a while, the thought reiterated itself that it was very cold and that he had never experienced such cold. As he walked along, he rubbed his cheekbones and nose with the back of his mittened hand. He did this automatically now and again, changing hands, but rub as he would, the instant he stopped, his cheekbones went numb, and the following instant, the end of his nose went numb. He was sure to frost his cheeks, he knew that, and experienced a pang of regret that he had not devised a nose strap of the sort Bud wore in cold snaps. Such a strap passed around the cheeks as well and saved them, but it didn't matter much after all. What were frosted cheeks? A bit painful, that was all, and they were never serious.
Empty as the man's mind was of thoughts, he was keenly observant, and he noticed the changes in the creek, the curves and the bends and the timber jams, and always he sharply noted where he placed his feet. Once, coming around a bend, he shied abruptly like a startled horse, curved away from the place where he had been walking, and retreated several paces back along the trail. The creek, he knew, was frozen clear to the bottom. No creek could contain water in that Arctic winter. But he knew also that there were springs that bubbled out from the hillside and ran along under the snow and on top of the ice of the creek. He knew that the coldest snaps never froze these springs. And he knew likewise their danger. They were traps. They hid pools of water under the snow that might be 3 inches deep or 3 feet. Sometimes a skin of ice half an inch thick covered them and in turn was covered by the snow. Sometimes there were alternate layers of water and ice skin, so that when one broke through, he kept on breaking through for a while, sometimes wetting himself to the waist.
That was why he had shied in such panic. He had felt the give under his feet and heard the crackle of a snow-hidden ice skin, and to get his feet wet in such a temperature meant trouble and danger. At the very least, it meant delay, for he would be forced to stop and build a fire and under its protection to bare his feet while he dried his socks and moccasins. He stood and studied the creek bed and its banks and decided that the flow of water came from the right. He reflected a while, rubbing his nose and cheeks, then skirted to the left, stepping gingerly and testing the footing for each step. Once clear of the danger, he took a fresh chew of tobacco and swung along at his 4-mile gait.
You know, I want to point out that London wrote an earlier version of this story for a boys magazine. And in that version, he gave the protagonist a name, Tom Vincent. He also did not have a dog in that story. But in this version, there is no name to the man. He's every man. And in that sense, he's mocking humans when we act as if we can just dominate our environment by sheer force of will. And now he has a dog. And the dog is a foil, and that's a contrasting character. This dog is a complete contrast. The dog is associated, we'll see, with instinctive wisdom. The man is associated with foolishness. He has a dependence on mere reason. This man knows the creek is frozen, but not entirely. He knows that they're hidden pools and they're under the surface. This man is not lacking knowledge. But notice the contrast between the man's reaction to the environment and the dog's reaction.
In the course of the next 2 hours, he came upon several similar traps. Usually the snow above the hidden pools had a sunken, candied appearance that advertised the danger. Once again, however, he had a close call. And once suspecting danger, he compelled the dog to go on in front. The dog did not want to go. It hung back until the man shoved it forward, and then it went quickly across the white, unbroken surface. Suddenly, it broke through, floundered to one side, and got away to firmer footing. It had wet its 4 feet and legs, and almost immediately the water that clung to it turned to ice. It made quick efforts to lick the ice off its legs and then dropped down in the snow and began to bite out the ice that had formed between the toes. This was a matter of instinct. To permit the ice to remain would mean sore feet. It did not know this. It merely obeyed the mysterious prompting that arose from the deep crypts of its being. But the man knew, having achieved a judgment on the subject, and he removed the mitten from his right hand and helped tear out the ice particles. He did not expose his fingers more than a minute and was astonished at the swift numbness that smote them. It certainly was cold. He pulled on the mitten hastily and beat the hand savagely across his chest.
So any immediate thoughts on that interaction?
Of course, the obvious one, this guy does not care at all about this dog. I mean, he's making the dog walk over the places where the ice could be thin. So if someone falls in, it's the dog and not him. He's willing to sacrifice the animal.
Exactly. I mean, survival of the fittest. But would you say that the survival of, in this case, is the most ethically fit? You know, let's jump.
Not according to Huxley.
No, let's jump to the paragraph where it's 12 o'clock and lunchtime.
He unbuttoned his jacket and shirt and drew forth his lunch. The action consumed no more than a quarter of a minute, yet in that brief moment, the numbness laid hold of the exposed fingers. He did not put the mitten on, but instead struck the fingers a dozen sharp smashes against his leg. Then he sat down on a snow-covered log to eat. The sting that followed upon the striking of his fingers against his leg ceased so quickly that he was startled. He had had no chance to take a bite of biscuit. He struck the fingers repeatedly and returned into the mitten, bearing the other hand for the purpose of eating. He tried to take a mouthful, but the ice muzzle prevented. He had forgotten to build a fire and thaw out. He chuckled at his foolishness. As he chuckled, he noted the numbness creeping into the exposed fingers.
You know, the success of this story has obviously nothing to do with the plot. I mean, he sits down on a snow-covered log to eat. His hands and feet are going numb. Oh, yeah, and he forgot to build a fire. I mean, the meaning of the story is conveyed in the mood, the setting, the atmosphere. Notice the endless repetition of how cold it is and what the cold is doing to the man. I want to point out that form supports theme. There's so much intentional repetition in the story because that's the essence of nature. Nature repeats. Nature is also sterile. And notice how sterile the narrator tells the story. It's facts. He knew. He chuckled. He noted the stinking in his toes. He wondered. He moved. He pulled the mitten. He stamped. The narrator is reporting thoughts, a few feelings, but mostly actions.
That man from Sulphur Creek had spoken the truth when telling how cold it sometimes got in the country, and he had laughed at him at the time. That showed one must not be too sure of things. There was no mistake about it. It was cold. He strode up and down, stamping his feet and thrashing his arms until reassured by the returning warmth. Then he got out matches and proceeded to make a fire. From the undergrowth where high water of the previous spring had lodged, a supply of seasoned twigs, he got his firewood. Working carefully from a small beginning, he soon had a roaring fire over which he thawed the ice from his face and into protection of which he ate his biscuits. For the moment, the cold of space was outwitted. The dog took satisfaction in the fire, stretching out close enough for warmth and far enough away to escape being singed. When the man had finished, he filled his pipe and he took his comfortable time over a smoke. Then he pulled on his mittens, settled the ear flaps of his cap firmly about his ears, and took the creek trail up the Left Fork. The dog was disappointed and yearned back toward the fire. This man did not know cold. Possibly all the generations of his ancestry had been ignorant of cold, of real cold, of cold 107 degrees below freezing point. But the dog knew, all its ancestry knew, and it had inherited the knowledge, and it knew that it was not good to walk abroad in such fearful cold. It was the time to lie snug in a hole in the snow and wait for the curtain of cloud to be drawn across the face of outer space whence this cold came. On the other hand, there was keen intimacy between the dog and the man. The one was the toil slave of the other, and the only caresses it had ever received were the caresses of the whiplash and of harsh and menacing throat sounds that threatened the whiplash. So the dog made no effort to communicate its apprehension to the man. It was not concerned in the welfare of the man. It was for its own sake that it yearned back toward the fire. But the man whistled and spoke to it with the sound of whiplashes, and the dog swung at the man's heels and followed after.
And so we see fire number one. There will be three fires. Traditionally, fire is an archetype for wisdom, knowledge, power. This man has knowledge to a limited degree. I mean, he can make a fire. He thinks he has power, but he most certainly lacks wisdom. The title of the story, To Build a Fire. Now think about that in terms of the symbolism. What does it mean to build a fire? Notice again the obvious contrast between the dog and the man. The dog's instincts are good. The man has no instincts. There's a choice. Maybe it's a moral choice, but really it's a cause and effect. Finally, I want to point out a new character, a man from Sulphur Creek who had spoken truth. But again, cause and effect. Our guy laughed at the man. The man told him to be careful in the cold. He ignored it, and there's an effect to that.
The man took a chew of tobacco and proceeded to start a new amber beard. Also, his moist breath quickly powdered with white his mustache, eyebrows, and lashes. There did not seem to be so many springs on the Left Fork of the Henderson, and for half an hour the man saw no signs of any. And then it happened. At a place where there were no signs, where the soft, unbroken snow seemed to advertise solidity beneath, the man broke through. It was not deep. He wetted himself halfway to the knees before he floundered out to the firm crust.
So I know that language could have been difficult, but this man falls into the water, and he gets wet halfway to his knees.
He was angry and cursed his luck aloud. He had hoped to get into camp with the boys at 6 o'clock, and this would delay him an hour, for he would have to build a fire and dry out his foot gear. This was imperative at that low temperature. He knew that much, and he turned aside to the bank, which he climbed. On top, tangled in the underbrush about the trunks of several small spruce trees, was a high water deposit of dry firewood, sticks and twigs principally, but also larger portions of seasoned branches and fine, dry last year's grasses. He threw down several large pieces on top of the snow. This served for a foundation and prevented the young flame from drowning itself in the snow it otherwise would melt. The flame he got by touching a match to a small shred of birch bark that he took from his pocket. This burned even more readily than paper. Placing it on the foundation, he fed the young flame with wisps of dry grass with the tiniest dry twigs. He worked slowly and carefully, keenly aware of his danger. Gradually, as the flame grew stronger, he increased the size of the twigs, which he fed it. He squatted in the snow, pulling the twigs out from their entanglement in the brush and feeding directly to the flame. He knew there must be no failure. When it is 75 below zero, a man must not fail in his first attempt to build a fire. That is, if his feet are wet. If his feet are dry and he fails, he can run along the trail for half a mile and restore his circulation. But the circulation of wet and freezing feet cannot be restored by running when it is 75 below. No matter how fast he runs, the wet feet will freeze the harder.
So we have fire number two.
All this the man knew. The old timer on Soulful Creek had told him about it the previous fall, and now he was appreciating the advice. Already all sensation had gone out of his feet. To build the fire, he had been forced to remove his mittens, and the fingers had quickly gone numb. His pace of 4 miles an hour had kept his heart pumping blood to the surface of his body and to all the extremities. But the instant he stopped, the action of the pump eased down. The cold of space smote the unprotected tip of the planet, and he, being on the unprotected tip, received the full force of the blow. The blood of his body recoiled before it. The blood was alive like the dog, and like the dog, it wanted to hide away and cover itself up from the fearful cold. So long as he walked 4 miles an hour, he pumped that blood willy-nilly to the surface. But now it ebbed away and sank down into the recesses of his body. The extremities were the first to feel its absence. His wet feet froze the faster, and his exposed fingers numbed the faster, though they had not yet begun to freeze. Nose and cheeks were already freezing, while the skin of all his body chilled as it lost its blood.
Notice how scientific, you know, that explanation was. I mean, we have no moral judgment, just the facts. One stops running in 75 below zero, one will lose blood in the extremities. Wet feet freeze.
But he was safe. Toes and nose and cheeks could be only touched by the frost, for the fire was beginning to burn with strength. He was feeding it with twigs the size of his finger. In another minute, he would be able to feed it with branches the size of his wrist, and then he could remove his wet foot gear, and while it dried, he could keep his naked feet warm by the fire, rubbing them at first, of course, with snow. The fire was a success. He was safe. He remembered the advice of the old-timer on Sulphur Creek and smiled. The old-timer had been very serious in laying down the law that no man must travel alone in a Klondike after 50 below. Well, here he was. He had had the accident, he was alone, and he had saved himself. Those old-timers were rather womanish, some of them, he thought. All a man had to do was to keep his head, and he was all right. Any man who was a man could travel alone. But it was surprising the rapidity with which his cheeks and nose were freezing, and he had not thought his fingers would go lifeless in so short a time. Lifeless they were, for he could scarcely make them move together to grip a twig, and they seemed remote from his body and from him. When he touched a twig, he had to look down and see whether or not he had hold of it. The wires were pretty well done between him and his finger ends.
You know, we see that the narrator still does not judge the man, but the man judges the old-timer who warned him not to travel alone. He called the man womanish, which is gendered language, but he's not complimenting the man. It's a way to call him weak. Such irony, because we as readers are now judging the man. But let me point out water. Water, just like fire, is a really important archetype. I mean, in almost every culture, water has the power to cleanse, but it also has the power to destroy. Just think of the flood narratives.
All of which counted for little. There was the fire, snapping and crackling and promising life with every dancing flame. He started to untie his moccasins. They were coated with ice. The thick German socks were like sheaths of iron halfway to his knees, and the moccasin strings were like rods of steel, all twisted and knotted as by some conflagration. For a moment, he tugged with his numb fingers, then realizing the folly of it, he drew his sheath knife. But before he could cut the strings, it happened. It was his own fault, or rather, his mistake. He should not have built the fire under the spruce tree. He should have built it in the open. But it had been easier to pull the twigs from the brush and drop them directly on the fire. Now the tree under which he had done this carried a weight of snow on its boughs. No wind had blown for weeks, and each bough was fully freighted. Each time he pulled a twig, he had communicated a slight agitation to the tree, an imperceptible agitation, so far as he was concerned, but an agitation sufficient to bring about the disaster. High up in the tree, one bough capsized its load of snow. This fell on the boughs beneath, capsizing them. This process continued in spreading out and involving the whole tree. It grew like an avalanche, and it descended without warning upon the man and the fire, and the fire was blotted out. Where it had burned was a mantle of fresh and disordered snow.
And of course, as a reader, we're thinking, you finally admit to a mistake. Because he'd been judging the old timer, and we know that that was a bad idea. But now he knows, and what a mistake. He builds a fire under a tree. The snow on the tree falls on his fire and puts out. Fire number two is gone.
The man was shocked. It was as though he had just heard his own sentence of death. For a moment he sat and stared at the spot where the fire had been. Then he grew very calm. Perhaps the old timer on Sulphur Creek was right. If he had only had a trail mate, he would have been in no danger now. The trail mate could have built a fire. Well, it was upon him to build the fire over again, and the second time there must be no failure. Even if he succeeded, he would most likely lose some toes. His feet must be badly frozen by now, and there would be some time before the second fire was ready. Such were his thoughts, but he did not sit and think them.
You know, we're going to need to cut a little bit of the story here, but what London describes is this man trying over and over to light a new fire, but his fingers are too cold to move. And of course, the dog just sits snug in the fur coat. I mean, the man is forced to take off his mittens and he tries to start the fire, but that doesn't work either. And after that, he can't even use his hands, so he has to try to start the fire with his mouth.
He was no better off. He could not pick it up. Then he devised a way. He picked it up in his teeth and scratched it on his leg. 20 times he scratched before he succeeded in lighting it. As it flamed, he held it with his teeth to the birch bark. But the burning brimstone went up his nostrils and into his lungs, causing him to cough spasmodically. The match fell into the snow and went out.
And so we almost have fire number three. He got the fire started with his mouth. But then the smoke went up his nose, and he accidentally blew it out.
The old-timer on Sulphur Creek was right. He thought in a moment of controlled despair that ensued. After 50 below, a man should travel with a partner. He beat his hands but failed in exciting any sensation. Suddenly, he bared both hands, removing the mittens with his teeth. He caught the whole bunch between the heels of his hands. His arm muscles, not being frozen, enabled him to press the hands tightly against the matches. Then he scratched the bunch along his leg. It flared into flame. 70 sulfur matches at once. There was no wind to blow them out. He kept his head to one side to escape the strangling fumes and held the blazing bunch to the birch bark. As so, he held it, he became aware of the sensation in his hand. His flesh was burning. He could smell it. Deep down below the surface, he could feel it. The sensation developed into pain that grew acute, and still he endured it, holding the flame in the matches clumsily to the bark that would not light readily because his own burning hands were in the way, absorbing most of the flame.
I mean, that just feels gross. I mean, fire number three is up and running, except he's burning his hand and he can smell it.
At last, when he could endure no more, he jerked his hands apart. The blazing matches fell sizzling into the snow, but the birch bark was alight. He began laying dried grasses and the tiniest twigs on the flame. He could not pick and choose, for he had to lift the fuel between the heels of his hands. Small pieces of rotten wood and green moss began to cling to the twigs, and he bit them off as well as he could with his teeth. He cherished the flame carefully and awkwardly. It meant life, and it must not perish. The withdrawal of blood from the surface of his body now made him begin to shiver, and it began to grow more awkward. A large piece of green moss fell squarely on a little fire. He tried to poke it out with his fingers, but his shivering frame made him poke too far, and he disrupted the nucleus of the little fire, the burning grasses and tiny twigs separating and scattering. He tried to poke them together again, but in spite of the tenseness of the effort, his shivering got away with him, and the twigs were hopelessly scattered. Each twig gushed a puff of smoke and went out. The fire provider had failed. As he looked apathetically about him, his eyes chanced on the dog, sitting across the ruins of the fire from him in the snow, making restless, hunching movements, slightly lifting one forefoot and then the other, shifting its weight back and forth on them with wistful eagerness.
And fire number three is out.
The sight of the dog put a wild idea into his head. He remembered the tale of the man caught in a blizzard who killed a steer and crawled inside the carcass and so was saved. He would kill the dog and bury his hands in the warm body until the numbness went out of them. Then he could build another fire.
Just survival of the fittest, except the man is not the fittest.
He spoke to the dog, calling it to him, but in his voice was a strange note of fear that frightened the animal, who had never known the man to speak in such a way before. Something was the matter, and its suspicious nature sensed danger. It knew not what danger, but somewhere, somehow, in its brain arose an apprehension of the man. It flattened its ears down as the sound of the man's voice and its restless, hunching movements and the liftings and shifting of its forefeet became more pronounced. But it would not come to the man. He got on his hands and knees, crawled toward the dog. This unusual posture once again excited suspicion, and the animal sidled mincingly away.
And again, let's paraphrase a part because we need to skip. But the man is going to be able to reach the dog. He holds the dog, but that's as far as he gets.
He realized he could not kill the dog. There was no way to do it. With his helpless hands, he could neither draw nor hold his sheath knife nor throttle the animal. He released it, and it plunged wildly away with tail between his legs and still snarling. It halted 40 feet away and surveyed him curiously with ears sharply pricked forward. The man looked down at his hands in order to locate them and found them hanging on the ends of his arms. It struck him as curious that one should have to use his eyes in order to find out where his hands were. He began threshing his arms back and forth, beating the mittened hands against his sides. He did this 4 or 5 times violently, and his heart pumped enough blood up to the surface to put a stop to his shivering, but no sensation was aroused in the hands. He had an impression that they were hung like weights on the ends of his arms, but when he tried to run the impression down, he could not find it.
A certain fear of death, dull and oppressive, came to him. This fear quickly became poignant as he realized that he was no longer a mere matter of freezing his fingers and toes or losing his hands and feet, but that it was a matter of life and death with the chances against him. This threw him into a panic, and he turned and he ran up the creek bed along the old dim trail. The dog joined in behind and kept up with him. He ran blindly without intention and fear such as he had never known in his life. Slowly, as he plowed and floundered through the snow, he began to see things again. The banks of the creek, the old timber jams, the leafless aspens, and the sky. The running made him feel better. He did not shiver. Maybe if he ran on, his feet would thaw out. And anyway, if he ran far enough, he could reach camp and the boys. Without a doubt, he would lose some fingers and toes and some of his face. but the boys would take care of him and save the rest of him when he got there. And at the same time, there was another thought in his mind that said he would never get to the camp and the boys, that it was too many miles away, that the freezing had too great a start on him, and that he would soon be stiff and dead. This thought he kept in the background and refused to consider. Sometimes it pushed itself forward and demanded to be heard, but he thrust it back and he strove to think of other things. And of course, he runs and he runs and he runs and he stumbles and he gets up and he runs again. And finally, he's going to fall and he can't give up anymore because he's not thawing out. And he continues to run. He'll walk. He'll run again. The dog keeps up. But let's see what happens when we pick up the story again. Gary?
The warmth and security of the animal angered him, and he cursed it till it flattened down its ears appeasingly. This time, the shivering came more quickly upon the man. He was losing in his battle with the frost. It was creeping into his body from all sides. The thought of it drove him on, but he ran no more than 100 feet when he staggered and pitched headlong. It was his last panic. When he had recovered his breath and control, he sat up and entertained in his mind the conception of meeting death with dignity. However, the conception did not come to him in such terms. His idea of it was that he had been making a fool of himself running around like a chicken with its head cut off. Such was the simile that occurred to him. Well, he was bound to freeze anyway, and he might as well take it decently. With his newfound peace of mind came the first glimmerings of drowsiness. A good idea, he thought, to sleep off to death. It was like taking an anesthetic. Freezing was not so bad as people thought. There were lots worse ways to die.
He pictured the boys finding his body the next day. Suddenly, he found himself with them, coming along the trail and looking for himself. And still with them, he came around the turn in the trail and found himself lying in the snow. He did not belong with himself anymore, for even then he was out of himself, standing with the boys and looking at himself in the snow. It certainly was cold, was his thought. When he got back to the States, he could tell the folks that what real cold was. He drifted on from this to a vision of the old-timer on Sulphur Creek. He could see him quite clearly, warm and comfortable and smoking a pipe. "You were right, old hoss. You were right," the man mumbled to the old-timer of Sulphur Creek.
Then the man drowsed off into what seemed to him the most comfortable and satisfying sleep he had ever known. The dog sat facing him and waiting. The brief day drew to a close in a long, slow twilight. There were no signs of a fire to be made, and besides, never in the dog's experience had it known a man to sit like that in the snow and make no fire. As the twilight drew on, its eager yearning for the fire mastered it, and with a great lifting and shifting of forefeet, it whined softly, then flattened its ears down in anticipation of being chidden by the man. But the man remained silent. Later, the dog whined loudly, and still later, it crept close to the man and caught the scent of death. This made the animal bristle and back away. A little longer it delayed, howling under the stars that leaped and danced and shone brightly in the cold sky. Then it turned and trotted up the trail in the direction of the camp it knew, where were the other food providers and fire providers. So this is deterministic. I mean, he ignored the advice of people he should have considered. He was heartless to a dog that might have helped him, and he was not observant to the limitations of his surroundings. I mean, in fact, he was foolish, and, you know, the laws of nature ran their course and did him in.
Right. I mean, those are the facts of the case. There's no disputing that. And yet, there is a lot of ambiguity embedded in the story. I mean, is London saying that this man is inferior to nature and his fate is limited? Is he saying that our fate is just determined by luck? I mean, is it bad luck that he got wet? I mean, is this about human arrogance? Is it a story about human isolation? Is it a story about refusing to listen? I mean, the man was told. It's a motif. Don't walk alone. Is this about being cruel to animals? After all, the dog wins our sympathy in the end. And most certainly, everyone knows he'll be okay and find the fire.
So is the answer to all those questions yes?
Yes. That's exactly it. I mean, these are all ideas embedded in naturalism, and they are all reflected in the narrative. Cause and effect, the neutrality of nature. But it's not all brutal. I mean, London is commenting, and he's making a statement in some sense of defiance. And if we are to have any empathy for this man, you know, the narrator provokes it as we watch him die. I mean, we see a little sympathy in the final words.
"You were right, old hoss, you were right," the man mumbled to the old timer of Sulphur Creek. Then the man drowsed off into what seemed to him the most comfortable and satisfying sleep he had ever known.
You know, once again, it comes down to responsibility. I mean, this is where we find our dignity and our respect as a human. This man, for all of his idiocy, his arrogance, his naivete, I mean, in the end, he doesn't blame the dog, nature, or the old man. His final words were, "You were right." And that's when he's able to sleep in peace, and a sense of dignity is given him.
And it seems that it's this ending that keeps the story in the mainstream year after year.
I know. I mean, there are other ways to see the story, but one way is to see all of us inside this guy. I mean, we've all been arrogant, foolish, naive. And if we've survived our own stupidity, I mean, likely it had more to do with dumb luck than any kind of skill. I mean, likely at some point or another, we've all deserved this exact fate of this man. And London represents this as journalistically as he possibly can. And so he begs the question, what is the proper response to our own naivete, our own stupidity? Well, for the naturalist, perhaps, it's a certain humility, because whether we survive or whether we don't, if we can own our choices and maybe get a little bit of luck here or there, maybe we too can become an old timer. And that's the kind of understanding that's both honest and refreshing, because in the end, perhaps what we all want to do is learn how we can build a fire. Symbolically, knowledge, power, and maybe a little bit of wisdom.
Well, there it is. Well, we hope you enjoyed our take on this popular tale from the Klondike. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, you can always find us at howtolovelitpodcast.com. On our website, we have listening guides for most of our episodes, as well as other teaching resources and materials. Also, whether you're a teacher, student, fellow lover of literature, please subscribe to our podcast via YouTube or Apple or Spotify and give us a rating. And if you like what you hear, possibly a review. It's when you share about the podcast to your friends on social media that we grow. Thank you for supporting us in our mission to make reading great literature accessible and enjoyable to as many people as possible.
Peace out.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.